Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, three smart people contemplate the political landscape 8 weeks from Election Day. We're going to talk about the top of the ticket, down ballot races, voter perspectives, 11th hour issues that may bubble up. You can join in on social media. Tweet me at CarrieNPR. And our roundtablers today, Pat Lopez is an editorial board member for the Star Tribune, where she was previously the political editor. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Carrie.
Brianna Bierschbach is a political reporter for MinnPost. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And Catherine Pearson is an associate professor of political science at the U of M. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
And we all know one another because we've done this together before. So that's a good thing. Okay. So, Pat, when I told you what we were going to talk about first, you were like, let me at it. So let me set this up a little bit. And I will say this isn't the most consequential thing that has happened on the campaign trail, but man, it's stuck in my craw. Mm-hmm. And I sense it's stuck in yours. So here's Donald Trump on his campaign plane in an interview with David Muir of ABC News talking about looking presidential. Let's listen.
Well, I just don't think she has a presidential look. And you need a presidential look. You have to get the job done. I think if she went to Mexico, she would have had a total failure. We had a big success.
But when you talk about her not looking presidential, are you talking about aesthetics here?
I'm talking about general. Hey, by the way, she says things about me that are horrible.
What that has to do with anything, I don't know. What do you think he means when he says Hillary Clinton doesn't look presidential, Pat?
Well, I think we all know what he means. What he means is she doesn't look like me.
or a man.
And I would say that it actually is of some consequence.
Do you?
Because, yes, and here's why. You know, we have heard things similar to this from Donald Trump throughout the campaign. You know, if you look Mexican, you can't be a judge. If you look like a woman, apparently you can't be president. He is sending signals to the, you know, what he perceives as his base, the essence of it is we need people that look like me. We need men. We need white, big white businessmen to run things. And, you know, and that's really disconcerting at a time when America is becoming more and more diverse and we've become more conscious of the need for that and the need to celebrate the fact that different people can do different things, that, you know, you can have Muslim judges, you can have Mexican judges, you can have all of the people in this country can do all of these things. There is no one way that a president has to look.
You know, Catherine, when Pat says he's sending a signal to his base, this surprised me because his numbers with women voters, including Republican and independent women voters, are dismal. Mm. He's sending a pretty powerful signal to them that I don't think he intends.
Well, that's right. He's reminding voters that every other president has been a man. And so Hillary Clinton would be the first woman, if she were to win, ever elected. And so with the Democratic base, of course, that's given voters a lot of enthusiasm. But with swing voters, that's a dangerous message because a lot of women are swing voters, particularly Republicans, who don't support Trump at the same level that Republican women have supported their party's candidate in the past. But on the other hand, gender stereotypes are powerful. Mm-hmm. And Clinton has done a lot to try to overcome them, both by gaining more experience than most presidential candidates have running for an open seat.
Which even the men admit,
yes.
By the way.
Yes, but if you actually look at women running for Congress to open seats and as challengers, they have more experience than their male counterparts. So women at every level of office literally have to have more experience to run for the same seats as men.
Brianna, I thought this was interesting because, as you know, Trump has a newish campaign advisor, Kellyanne Conway, who's been a longtime GOP Republican pollster. And she was asked about this and she said in an interview, women look at the full measure of the man, not just one comment.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised she said that. I guess this is her job,
right.
Isn't it? Right? I don't think
that helps, by the way.
Right. Well, yeah, and I mean, if you look at the full measure of the man, his comments have been consistently, unpopular with women. And it's really interesting to see. I actually went to a campaign event in the suburbs. Wendy Davis came to be basically a surrogate
out of Texas.
Yeah. State senator, a former state senator from Texas who ran for governor. She came and campaigned for Hillary, and she specifically targeted these suburban women voters.
Interesting.
And she specifically talked about Trump and Trump's comments toward women and what they should do with their bodies, what they shouldn't do with their bodies. And it was very interesting to see them specifically target this demographic, because I think they know, as in past elections, they've swung what's happened.
So are these women who would sit it out, or are these women who can actually be brought over into Hillary Clinton's side?
You know, that's the unknown. I saw one poll that showed that there's a strong gender gap running in her favor with single women.
Right.
But not with married women.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I'd love to know more about the reason for that. But I don't think it's a given that she can necessarily draw them in.
I'm really glad you mentioned that. I just want to say, Catherine, that unmarried women basically gave the re-election to President Obama. He has them to thank, right, in 2012. Right.
Unmarried women and women of color. So if you just look at white women, in fact, white women tend to support the Republican candidate. Now, at lower rates than white men, but nonetheless, more white women tend to vote for the Republican candidate than the Democratic candidate. And so the gender gap has been consequential in every election since 1980, when it really first emerged. But it will likely be particularly significant this year in determining the winner.
I have one note that isn't, it is political, but kind of tangentially, it's not about the campaign. Phyllis Schlafly died this week, and she has endorsed Donald Trump before she died, caused quite a split in her organization. As it happens, I was just finishing Gloria Steinem's memoir, because she's coming for Talking Volumes, and she writes about how, as they were organizing the first women's convention in Houston, Phyllis Schlafly organized a shadow convention, like right across the street from the convention center, and she declared the Equal Rights Amendment anti-family and anti-God. And I was thinking about Phyllis Schlafly and wondering if, party identification aside, she thought a major party candidate as a woman at the top of the ticket was any kind of progress at all. I mean, okay, she usually voted Republican, but when you've got a major party candidate as a woman at this stage of the campaign, whether she would have seen that as progress, either any of you guys?
Whether Schlafly would have seen
this
as progress?
I mean, not Clinton herself, but just the idea of it.
Doesn't seem like she would have. I mean, she opposed equal rights. She seemed to think women belonged in the home, tending the children.
And she was a powerful woman herself.
Yes,
that's kind of the weird part
of
that.
She made a huge impact, but she held very traditional views about the role of women. So I can't imagine she would have been
which she
kind
of defied, by the way.
Yes.
You know, she did a lot of traveling and a lot of speaking.
Yeah, they always seem to exempt themselves, you know, from that.
There is that. Okay. We did a show on Monday about how education levels intersect with voting behavior. Boy, this is interesting. And Asma Khalid from NPR was one of the guests, and she was talking about going to Colorado, which has the highest percentage of white college-educated voters in the country, and what she discovered that meant in a swing state like Colorado. So listen to that.
I think at the beginning of the election season, a lot of people considered Colorado this true battleground, a really purple terrain. And increasingly, polls seem to suggest the state at least is a likely Democratic state this election cycle. And maybe this is the beginning of a tilt towards a more blue state in general. And part of what I found is that seems to be linked to the high degree of college education in the state.
What do you hear in that?
Well, if you look at support for Trump more generally, it's correlated with both measures of racial resentment among his voters, but also levels of education and economic anxiety. So I think these things really come together, which is why we're talking more about the difference between college-educated voters than we have in previous elections.
Well, it sounds like she's equating, college education with Democratic leanings. I think, you know, there are many people who would argue that there are Republicans who have, you know, completed college and still retain their Republican values. But I do think there is a clear correlation between the lack of education and the acceptance of the, you know, the little tiny sound bites that Trump offers on policy. And I think the more education you have, the more your detector goes off and says, wait a minute, that's not true, because you know things about climate change, about military plans, about our history, about the Constitution, that make you automatically more skeptical.
Well, and also higher levels of education are correlated with sort of being receptive to some of the cues from Republican elites who are not supportive of Trump. And so those with higher levels of education are more likely to be sort of attuned to generals and Republican elected officials who have expressed some real concerns about Trump's leadership, sort of the echo chamber inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C., that's, you know, playing out in The Washington Post and The New York Times.
Yeah, Brianna, go ahead.
Well, I think it's more of the middle class message. Certainly a lot of people who went to college are in the middle class, but it's more likely that if you didn't go to college, you might have a lower paying job. And you think about where Trump's message in Minnesota particularly resonates, and polling kind of goes back and forth. But they say on the Iron Range, where jobs are being lost over the mining issue, where there's general depression and people moving out of the area, that his message resonates with people who are of the middle class. And I don't necessarily know that that's exactly tied to education, but I do think that it's more of an economic issue than it is an education issue.
Yeah. Pat, you said you mentioned little tiny sound bites when it comes to policy. I think this forum that we heard earlier this week, where they were at, it was the billed as the Commander in Chief forum, was a pretty good example of that. There's a stream of consciousness kind of to some of these answers about where, you know, you're really trying to understand how A links to B in his logic on this. Maybe this question and answer about what he would do about ISIS and the generals is an example of this. Let's listen.
Well, the generals under Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have not been successful.
Do you know more about ISIS than they do?
I think under the leadership of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, the generals have been reduced to rubble.
What do you hear in that?
What does that even
mean? What does that mean?
You know, it's one of those little, little tiny sound bites that it sounds like it means something, but when you examine it, it really doesn't. And part of what he's doing is undermining, again, confidence in public institutions, this time confidence in our military. I think that is really such an outrageous assertion to say that our generals have been reduced to rubble. This is the military of the most powerful country in the world and one of the most effective militaries. You know, do they have a secret 30-day plan to defeat ISIS? No. Because one doesn't exist, and he's not going to have one either. To say something like that without any evidence to back it up, I just think demands either that he produce some evidence or that he apologize, because it's just ridiculous.
Oddly, he's still, now I don't know what it looks like today after those comments, but he still commands a certain amount of a higher level of support among military families than Hillary Clinton does. I mean, that's what the most recent poll showed. Explain that.
Well, that's also a large function of partisan identification. I mean, partisan identification
just like
is,
I always vote Republican and that's it.
Yes. In typical presidential elections, 9 out of 10 people who identify with one party or the other, even weekly, tend to vote for their party's candidate. Now, I think this election will put that to the test, again, because Republican electeds and elites are not sort of uniformly enthusiastic about Trump, and some have even come out against him. But in general, party ID is strong and durable from one election to the next. So even if some Republicans defect and don't vote for Trump in this election, you know, they'll likely vote for the Republican again.
Well, one thing that's been interesting, too, is this entire time, it doesn't seem to necessarily matter what he says. Mm-hmm. This seems to be an election based on feelings and how people
personality.
Feel. And
yeah.
Personality, how people right. feel about Trump, how people feel about Hillary. And a comment like that, it's just what's been happening this entire time, and nothing seems to make a dent, make a
it's
difference.
It's another signal. You know, what it's really supposed to do is not convey any important policy position, but just to comfort people that, you know, that he will have all the answers. You bring me in, I'll bring in new generals, we'll win this war, 30 days, nothing flat. Of course, you know, anyone who stops to think about that is going to realize it's not possible. But they don't want the hard answer.
Here's Hillary Clinton's answer to that from earlier this week. Let's listen.
He says he has a secret plan to defeat ISIS. But the secret is he has no plan. After all his talk, the only thing that is clear is he has no clue about what he's talking about.
Hillary Clinton from the campaign trail, and the he that she's talking about is Donald Trump. Brianna, I want to come to you on if you're running on the Republican ticket with Donald Trump at the top of it, how are you adjusting to these day-to-day pronouncements that you're going to be asked about, that you have to say something about? So what are you seeing on that?
You know, it really depends on where you are, what part of the state you're in. I think if you look at Minnesota specifically, you know, Tom Emmer, for instance, has embraced Trump and has really been a big supporter of his, because he's in a very conservative district where these pronouncements aren't necessarily going to raise as many questions.
And that's going to hurt him.
Potentially, yes. Stuart Mills, though, up in the 8th district, is really hoping that he captures this feeling, this sort of this economic depression and a feeling that things aren't going to change unless we have a big change. But then if you look at Eric Paulson.
What does Eric Paulson do?
He is keeping his distance. I mean, he said he has to earn my vote. He has to earn my support. And that's politically a very smart move. Trump did terribly in the suburbs in Minnesota in the caucuses. And I think that he sees that that's going to continue on into the general election.
Does Eric Paulson, though, get asked day to day? You agree with that? That the generals are rubble? Do you agree with that? You know, some of the other stuff that he has a 30-day. Is it possible to have a 30-day plan to defeat ISIS?
He's not provided a lot of those opportunities.
I was going to say, is he being held to, you know, account for whether he thinks Trump is right?
I think, you know, he's made his position, you know, his attempt to straddle the middle pretty clear. Voters are going to have to take from that what they will. This idea that Trump has to earn my vote. Well, what possibly could he do to earn that vote? That is what I would like to know.
Yeah.
What could he do that would negate all of the things that he has said in the past and get you to a position where you could support him?
And if he doesn't earn your vote, does that mean your vote's going to somebody else, or you're not voting, or isn't that the next question?
I think as we get closer, to Election Day, has he earned your vote yet? Who are you going to vote for? Because in theory, a congressman is going to cast a vote in the election.
They vote everyone else.
Yeah.
Right. And what's so interesting about this cycle is Trump's presence has attracted some quality challengers on the Democratic side, because there are just not that many seats that are even competitive in the entire U.S. And if you look at the presidential vote, certainly Minnesota's third is one of them. And so here is a state senator with Terry Bonoff, with electoral experience, who was strategic about when she decided to run. You know, she didn't run 2 years ago. She's running in a presidential cycle when Democratic turnout tends to be higher than it is in midterms, and in an environment where Trump is a weakness for Paulson. But on the other hand, Paulson still has the advantages of an incumbent running for re-election with a record, and which can cut both ways. But nonetheless, he's known for voters, can raise ample resources for his campaign. And even as voters are less likely to split their ticket today than they have been in the past, it still does happen.
I do think there should be room for a candidate, even an incumbent, to declare themselves to be somewhat independent in that regard.
Absolutely.
They don't have to pledge allegiance to a presidential candidate. Part of that right is to not declare it and let the chips fall where they may. I just think, you know, both sides are eager to make this a litmus test. Are you for him or against him? Well, you know, really, I think down ballot voters have bigger issues to look at in that regard. And one is, you know, how the Congress person performs in their district, you know, whether he or she lines up with their values. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, of course, factor in whether they're going to be an ally of the incoming president or not. But, you know.
Well, one interesting thing I've heard from a lot of Republicans is that Republican voters and people who align with the Republican Party don't necessarily think Trump is a Republican, or don't necessarily in their minds tie him to other Republican candidates. They don't think they're the same thing necessarily.
So, voters are saying this, or politicians?
Polling. And when they look into you know, how is Eric Paulson doing? Is he doing as poorly as Trump in this area? He's not. He's sort of standing on his own. Obviously, we're going to have to, it's a really this is an election that's sucking all the oxygen out of the room. And will local candidates be able to stand on local issues? Will they be able to push this away? Will be a really interesting question.
That was my next question. Do you have a sense of that? I mean, when they want to talk about the stuff that matters to their district, is there any room for that?
Well, I've gone out door knocking with some candidates, and really, a lot of people ask about the presidential race. Mm-hmm. So they'll be like, hey, here's my position on this issue and this issue. And they'll be like, well, what do you think of Hillary? Or what do you think of Donald? Mm-hmm. Or what do you think about this thing they said? So it's really, it's not certainly an example. I haven't been to every district in the state, but it does come up a lot. And that's just conventional wisdom. There's less room for local issues to rise up in a presidential year, especially in a year when there's no statewide race on the top of the ticket. So there's no one, there's no governor, there's no U.S. senator also helping to focus elections in Minnesota on issues in Minnesota.
You're right. Well, but as you've just said, somebody said it's about personality and not issues anyway. Mm-hmm. So if there was ever going to be a driving issue, the personality seems to have drowned
the personality,
that out.
And we've got a long record now of nationalizing these elections. I think you and I can both remember, Carrie, when that wasn't always the case. But the parties themselves have been participants in this, in trying to make this all about the national election, and this time that becomes a lot more problematic.
That's right. And the national, and the groups both in Minnesota or nationally, a lot of the ads look the same from district to district and even from state to state, because the top of the ticket, the presidential race, is so critically important. Right. But there still is room for the notion that all politics is local. And I'm sure state legislative candidates are really pushing this as hard as they can. Remember, they're not in TV. They're doing the door knocking and they're really trying to make their own case. But these sort of individual local races will add up to who controls, the legislature in Minnesota. So it's a very consequential election for Minnesota, even as these battles are being fought, sort of door to door in the state legislative races.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. You can hear us talking politics. Our roundtablers today, Brianna Bierschbach from MinnPost, Catherine Pearson from the University of Minnesota, and Pat Lopez from the Star Tribune. Catherine, to come back to you, on Congress. I was surprised to see, I think it was an article earlier this week in Politico, where Mitch McConnell was expressing a surprising amount of confidence about hanging on to the U.S. Senate. Has something changed in the last month or so that they feel better about this?
Well, I think they're feeling better about Florida than they did when it didn't look like Rubio would be running for re-election. Right. And I think they're feeling better about incumbent Rob Portman's chances in the U.S. Senate against former Governor Strickland in Ohio. That said, the structural advantages for Democrats candidates in the Senate are pretty huge. So Democrats need 5 seats to get to a 51-seat majority in the Senate, 4 seats to tie, and then, of course, it matters who wins the presidency, and the vice president breaks the tie. And, 3 seats are sort of all but foregone conclusions. And of the 34 seats that are up, 24 are being defended by Republicans. Because remember, a lot of these Republicans won during the Republican wave for the first time in 2010. And so Republicans they're at a serious disadvantage after being so advantaged 2 years ago. But the question is, how many seats will it be?
I also think McConnell's putting a lot of faith in ticket splitters.
Do you?
Yeah.
And should he?
Yeah. Well, I think, Trump has created such a unique brand for himself that it's easier for a Republican voter to either not vote for him or to vote for Hillary, but still vote for the Republicans that they know that line up with everything they believe in. So, yes, I think there's some. Whether it's enough to keep their majority in the Senate, I think that's an open question.
So let's imagine a scenario that, let's say that Democrats take back the Senate and let's say they win the White House. It's still a very powerful opposing force to have a Republican House.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
And Democrats would need to win 30 additional House seats to take back majority control. And that's just highly unlikely. There just aren't that many competitive seats in the country.
Hypothetical.
And in the Senate, they won't take enough to get rid of the filibuster.
Right.
And as we know, that is what hampers a lot of business from moving forward in the Senate. So it's still going to be very tightly balanced.
But imagine an incoming, in this hypothetical, imagine an incoming Democratic president with just the edgiest of margins in the U.S. Senate. and a House that sees itself as now the prime opposition to the agenda of, to the mandate of that incoming president. Can that president really get anything done?
Well,
factor into a
Republican House that for 8 years has been in the habit of opposing the Democratic president simply to deny him any kind of a victory. Is that a habit they're prepared to break for someone like Hillary Clinton? It's hard to see.
Right. I mean, certainly after the 2010 elections, that was the dynamic for President Obama. You know, for a while, he enjoyed a Democratic Senate, but a Republican House. But it also depends on the dynamics within the Republican conference, how big the Freedom Caucus is, how much resistance they have to Speaker Ryan. Speaker Ryan is, you know, not surprisingly, just as Speaker Boehner had in the past, run into trouble with the Freedom Caucus. But I think one of the Freedom Caucus, you know, leaders was defeated in a Republican primary by a more moderate Republican this summer. And so it remains to be seen what the Republican conference looks like and whether or not, and again, the divisions within the Republican conference are not so much ideological. They're much more about the role of institutions and the role of compromise and sort of the Congress's role in governing.
Well, and the funny thing is the situation you described is exactly the situation we have in Minnesota right now. We have a Democratic governor and a split legislature. And what happened, the Republicans with the control they had in the House, which was the only place they had control, really pushed back on getting a lot of basically passing a lot of things because they said if we can't do certain things, we're at least going to block you from doing things that we believe to be bad.
Right.
And we had an incredibly unproductive 2 years in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And more people think state politics mirror national politics, where it used to be, you know, they used to be more productive on the state level.
They got pretty good at foiling Governor Dayton's agenda there,
they did.
And I think recruiting some DFLers who didn't love some of the things on his agenda too.
Sure. I mean, they were able to find weaknesses on the other side.
They checkmate each other, and nothing happens.
Right. So what we're looking forward to potentially 4 more years of paralysis. Oh,
well,
man.
You would have to have, you know, if Hillary Clinton were to become president, she'd have to find a way to build coalitions in the House and the Senate. And somehow get them to consensus on the type of things she's proposed. That's going to be a very, very difficult task.
Do you remember at the beginning of the campaign, that's what she used to talk about, is I'm a practical, progressive, I'm somebody who knows how to get... You don't hear much about that anymore.
Bernie pushed her quite a bit farther to the left. And if you look at some of the things that she's been proposing now on college education, on a number of other fronts, on immigration, it's really hard to see where the coalitions come from in the House and the Senate to move those agendas forward.
I just have to say something about this college education thing, which just, it doesn't add up. I know Sanders pushed her on the free college. States would have to appropriate the money.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, you would have to, I mean, this is a whole nother conversation,
know,
but you would
but
have
to
somehow
to
get
it.
Control of the costs first, which would mean imposing a new level of, fiscal stringence on public colleges and universities, and then bringing into line tuition and then funding it. It's a big nut to crack.
Listeners who look at that, and she's been talking about it in certain audiences, the numbers really don't do it. Catherine?
I think that's right. I think it's much easier to imagine sort of very incremental policymaking in this area.
Mm-hmm. It sounds great, though. I mean, everybody said, okay, so I would have free tuition if I, you know, do certain things, but it's really hard. And I've talked to some state legislators. Would the state be able to front their part of it? It's certainly part of it's funded by the federal government, but the state would have to cough up money too. They said we'd try, but what if they didn't? What if they couldn't find agreement on that? Then it just doesn't.
Some college and university systems have great latitude built in, as it is in Minnesota, into the Constitution, how much they're able to control their fate.
I didn't know that. Specifically, does that work?
I think, you help me out on this, Catherine. There are things that the university has control over that even the state can't interfere with. They can control the funding, but they can't force the university to change administration policies or to, impose cutbacks.
That's really the regent's role.
Yeah, the classic example of this, just one more thing on this, is someone like Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, who is not going to succumb, I wouldn't think, to, sure, we'll meet you halfway on that and make to it. He's been cutting money out of the education system in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and that's not a good way to do it, because, you know, it's something that has to be done jointly so that it's done in an intelligent way, not just, you know, drive off your best professors because they have options to go elsewhere and you have this chaotic situation where cuts are coming, you don't know where they're going to land, there's no plan for dealing with it. The college's first instinct is to push back and, you know, say, well, then we'll have to close down the humanities, you know. It's just not a good way to do it.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation, as you can hear, about politics. We've got Brianna Bierschbach from MinnPost, Pat Lopez from the Star Tribune, and Catherine Pearson from the University of Minnesota. A look at the latest news, and then right back to our conversation.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom. Donald Trump's campaign manager isn't saying what Trump would do in response to North Korea's launch of ballistic rockets, but she tells CBS he would not do what's being done now. North Korea today conducted its fighth nuclear test just 8 months after it claimed it successfully detonated a small hydrogen bomb. It was the first time the North conducted two nuclear tests in 1 year. The White House has condemned the nuclear test, and President Obama says the U.S. will never accept North Korea as a nuclear state. Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein says she's working with North Dakota authorities to arrange a court date on charges stemming from a protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Stein has acknowledged spray painting construction equipment on Tuesday. She and her running mate are facing misdemeanor counts of criminal trespass and criminal mischief. Stein defended her actions to the Chicago Tribune, saying it would have been inappropriate for her not to show support for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. The tribe says the pipeline threatens sacred sites and drinking water. A judge today is supposed to rule on the tribe's request to block that project. Hundreds of people who came face-to-face with the horror of 9/11 are now serving as volunteer tour guides at the rebuilt World Trade Center complex in New York. One is a woman who walked down 82 flights of stairs to escape the burning North Tower. Another guide is a retired doctor who lost his son, an equity trader for Cantor Fitzgerald. He takes a train from Washington each month to lead tours. The tours are organized by the 9/11 Tribute Center, a nonprofit that presents the attacks and the aftermath as journeys of survival. Some guides say recounting their stories has helped them with their emotional recovery. The 15th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks is on Sunday. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:38.
Later, Minnesotans from across the state recall how the kidnapping of Jacob Wetterling changed their lives.
My older brother was too afraid to walk home after that happened. It affected everybody.
I'm Tom Cran. Join me for that and all the day's news. All Things Considered starts at 3.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
Programming is supported by the College of St. Scholastica, debuting its new MBA in Leadership and Change Management. Evening classes start September in Duluth, St. Paul, and St. Cloud. CSS.edu/MBA.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is the Friday Roundtable's conversation about politics. Catherine Pearson with us from the University of Minnesota, Brianna Bierschbach with us from MinnPost, and Pat Lopez with us from the Star Tribune, where she's an editorial board member. You flagged something that Donald Trump has been drawn out on this week, and that is his admiration for Putin. And apparently it's mutual.
Yes, it appears to be. And that alone should cause some consternation. But I think one of the more alarming things I've heard him say is he not only expressed admiration for Putin, but also said that he admired him in particular because of the great control he has over his country.
Yeah, his answer to that was, well, he can get things done. Now, I don't like the system that he does that, but he can get things done.
I can't think of another American presidential candidate who could express admiration for the Russian president, say he's been a better leader than ours has, but then in particular say that he admires the iron fist that Putin wields
in
that country.
You're holding him to the wrong standard, Pat. You're holding him to the usual political standard.
But this is a message for voters. This is a message. This is not a message for Republicans inside the Beltway. He has already been criticized by prominent Republican foreign policy experts and Republican foreign policy leaders, former White House aides, academics. And so he knows that they don't support him. He's now going for swing voters and projecting this tough image.
Okay. It's this strongman, this dictatorial image.
What is attractive to the swing voter about that?
Someone who is strong and tough, and it's And again, I don't think that swing voters are paying that close of attention, because otherwise, for the most part, they wouldn't be swing voters. You know, that's not true in all cases.
That's true.
But there is a strong correlation between the strength of party identification and how close of attention you pay to politics. So,
I don't know, though. Are you sure that it's an appeal to swing voters, though? To me, when I hear him say things like that, I think it is a message to a base that we don't really know. Because not everybody turns out to vote in any election. You know, lots and lots of people stay home. If you can motivate those people that normally stay home, you get an election that's completely out of the box. And I'll go back to Jesse Ventura here.
Yeah.
All the polls were wrong. Why? Because we couldn't predict the type of people that he brings out.
Right.
So maybe his calculation is, I'm never going to get, you know, the average swing voter that's weighing policies and looking at, I just need to get more of my people out. I need to get that guy, you know, and forgive the stereotype here, who's sitting in a trailer park, who hasn't voted in the last 10 elections, to say, by gosh, this is the election I'm going to vote in.
Typically unmotivated.
Right. Well, it is certainly true that every candidate has sort of they have to balance their appeals to the base to make sure that they turn out and appeals to swing voters. But it is not the case that swing voters are sitting carefully weighing the policies of both candidates. Swing voters likely aren't really even paying that much attention yet, and they may or may not vote, depending on, you know, what they're thinking or their schedules in the days before the election.
This is the kind of stuff that drives me crazy about swing voters. Come on, we're 8 weeks out there now. Why is it acceptable to not be paying attention? I know you get to live your life and vote whether you like or not. But Brianna, you were going to say?
Oh, well, I was just going to say, you know, at what point does Trump stop going for these people that I assume already support him? And when does he start going for this swing voter, or even the more independent, more moderate voter, and the people who do go out to the polls? Because he has these supporters. Do we know if they're going to go out and vote? We don't know that. So I think that's a really interesting question.
You bring up something really important, which is like the split personality of the campaign. So sometimes it looks like he's very clearly reaching out to those voters that you just talked about. The way he did the event in Mexico, right, with the Mexican brand. Then he arrives back in Arizona, in Phoenix, and he's clearly speaking to the other kinds of voters that he wants to fire up. It's like a schizophrenic kind of campaign strategy, which I wonder, is that deliberate, or is that the measure of Trump campaigning the way Trump does?
Trump does not have previous electoral experience, and I think that's very important. You know, many of his advisors do, but he also lacks the network of advisors that a lot of Republican candidates have enjoyed in the past, in part because of some of his policy positions or lack thereof, in part because of his temperament, and in part because he really doesn't want the typical party apparatus. But another way in which we're seeing some sort of real break from the past in terms of strategy is a lack of a solid ground game in all of the states that could be competitive. And so political scientists tend to think that, you know, for the most part, ads and campaign activities in the ground game of major party presidential candidates cancel each other out. You know, that's not true at the congressional level, but I don't think that's true in this cycle. It certainly doesn't appear to be. And I think we're really underestimating the importance of the ground game, given the differences between the two candidates that we're beginning to see.
Some of this is why you look at swing states that should not be in play for Hillary Clinton being in play. And I had to share this with you guys. I was reading Emma Green in The Atlantic about how Utah may be a swing state this year. Trump has actually said on the campaign trail that he is struggling with Utah.
Texas may go blue.
And Texas, yeah. And Green quotes a political scientist out of the University of Nebraska who says about Utah, "Mormons have in some ways become the stand-ins for Americans and especially white traditional values Americans. Trump more than say the fact that his support is slipping in deep red Georgia. He viscerally gets the fact that the Mormons aren't lining up behind him. He feels this represents that he isn't tapping into something that is true about America. In other words, it kind of drives him crazy that he's not, that he may not win Utah. And Texas, I assume, too.
Yeah.
Well, right?
Texas, I think, you know, with its large Hispanic population, that probably explains it right there. And I think that's where you'll see a lot of ticket splitting. Texas may go blue in the presidential race. I'm pretty sure they'll still reelect most of their Republican down ballot candidates.
Yeah, don't you think it's going to take a couple more cycles? Although I suggested this in a show, and one of our guests pushed back and said, I don't think it's going to take as long as you think for Texas to be purple or blue.
It may not. And you know, all you have to do is look at you know, certain parts of Minnesota that we always assumed would be red and then just flipped.
That's
and they
right.
kind of stayed that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You were going to say, Catherine?
Oh, yeah. I'm hesitant to suggest that Texas is a real swing state in this particular cycle, but demographic changes toward the future clearly suggest that Texas will move into that purple swing state category in the future. But I don't know about this cycle.
Here's my question about the debates. Why do they matter when most voters have made up their minds?
Well, it's going to be a good question. And also when it appears Trump can say certain things and not have to back them up.
Right.
And he can continue to go on and, you know, climb up in the polls. I think it will be important, though, to see these two candidates sitting next to each other, maybe more than that. But it doesn't seem like the polls are suggesting there's going to be a third person involved in the debates or one of these third party
right.
candidates. But to see how they interact with each other, I don't really think we've seen that yet. And maybe this sort of direct contrast of I do think that if you have Hillary sitting down and talking about policy, if the debate is focused on policy, it will be a stark contrast from Trump. But it'll also be a stark contrast of their styles, which some people love Trump's style and some people don't love Hillary's style. So I think it'll be important. We have to have these things, right? We have to have these opportunities.
Yeah.
But whether they change people's minds or not, I don't know.
Yeah, political scientists generally view debates as sort of overemphasized and overrated by the media in terms of actually determining vote choice. That said, they will be important focal points for the campaign to come. And I think people will be particularly interested this cycle because of the dramatic differences sort of at every level with the two candidates. It will be in some ways political theater playing out so that people will want to watch. But the people who will be watching, again, are people who've been paying attention, likely have already made up their mind.
Right.
But the media interpretation will reach people who won't necessarily watch and who perhaps have not made up their mind.
I think, you know, I would love to see the debates be about, you know, discussions on mental health policy and immigration and college and climate change and all those good topics. But, you know, the reason the debates are important really is because it presents an opportunity to massively screw up. You know, those game changing moments that suddenly flip, you know, leads and, you know, set one candidate at a disadvantage. And so you're going to see them both, first of all, trying not to provide one of those moments.
Although, again, as Catherine says, Trump is really unconventional.
He is, and
so
it's easy to gig him.
About that
you
moment.
Know, you
right.
can bait him. And I have to say, I have wondered ever since that Mexico visit, you know, where he attempted to be the diplomat at first, you know, and is in his understanding of it, and then was so fiery that night. And I couldn't help wondering how much of that was because Peña Nieto tweeted out that little very humiliating to Trump that he should be contradicted by the Mexican president. And I think that fueled
that
a huge because so much of what he does is spontaneous, you know, it's almost stream of consciousness.
Well,
kind
it's like the bite we heard earlier about, well, she says mean things about
that's
me
right,
so
yeah.
I say mean things about her. So debate prep, what does that look like then if for Hillary Clinton if you're up against somebody who's pretty volatile and breaks the rules and has gotten to this point because he breaks the rules.
Well, I thought the clip you played before of her saying his secret plan is he has no plan. She kind of needs to do more of that, I think. Succinct answers, really kind of turning his style around on him. And I imagine that her advisors are going to try to help her do that. She's not always comfortable doing that, though.
Right. I think she needs to be prepared for the counterpunch because that is Trump's specialty. He lets you do something and that gives him license to punch back hard. And for him, he needs to avoid being so easily baited.
Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, certainly she is an experienced debater, having run and been elected to the Senate and certainly gone through the nomination process twice. But Trump is unusual. So I'm sure she's practicing not so much her policy answers. I'm sure she's got those down cold, but just sort of how to deal with a very unconventional candidate and not appear overly defensive, but yet make her point well known. And I'm thinking back to her debate with Rick Lazio when she was running to the Senate, and he sort of got in her face, and that really backfired on him. So she has good experience.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. We're talking politics with Pat Lopez from the Star Tribune, Brianna Bierschbach from MinnPost, and Catherine Pearson from the University of Minnesota. One of the things that we noted off air, And I think this is going to be really interesting, is that early voting opens in some states before that first debate. Now, let's just also say, Catherine, to what you say about involved voters, they are the ones who are going to be early voting. So it isn't like, again, they're waiting for their minds to be made up. Fair to say?
I think that is fair to say. I mean, certainly, you know, this sort of notion in the media of the October surprise lurks out there. Will there be, I mean, we actually do know that there will be more emails released, but Clinton emails released. But, you know, will there be an October surprise on Trump's part? Even October surprises, the worst of them are typically overrated by the press. You know, the press needs something to cover every day. And
yes,
readers and
well
listeners are not as...
You know, I'm about at my limit with the number of times you're going to talk about the press and how we overrate things, Catherine.
Well, and I mean, I'm sympathetic, but you know, study after study shows that what readers and listeners and viewers are getting from the media is horse race coverage, the latest poll, the latest gaffe, and not a lot of serious policy introspection. They're watching cable and they're not reading
the paper, and they're not listening to public radio and reading MinnPost, right? But that's true.
You know, the information is all out there.
It is.
If people are willing to search it out. That said, yes, I think you're right that, you know, too much of it has been geared toward, you know, clickbait.
And
this election now worse than ever.
But then again, when it is a race about personality, that drives that kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because while there are sharp policy differences, the way these candidates are disagreeing is so much about personality. Trump, basically.
Right. Well, and you know, this is no secret, and it's not a new development. People have always looked at personalities, how they feel about a certain candidate.
Yeah.
You know, how it's more ephemeral than a lot of us would like to admit. And, you know, having been covering things like this for a long time, I know that. I know that just from having talked to so many voters in so many elections. You know, I've talked to people who they shake a candidate's hand, and that touch, you know, makes a difference to them.
Right.
Why? It doesn't change one single policy position. But I also think voters have seen so many candidates change policy once they get in office that they're very suspicious of that. And so they go with things that they think they can trust more.
Brianna, I know you've been out with the candidates. So is this true? What voters are, how they're reacting?
Well, when you talk about a feeling, when it comes to, we've had a Democratic president for two terms, and no Democrat has won after that situation since LBJ.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a huge overwhelming feeling that's all around the country. And it's in Minnesota too, that Hillary is up against. That's just something she has to deal with. And that feeling people can't describe. People don't know what it is. It's just there. And I think you see that in Minnesota. I think you do see a desire to change and really a frustration that they don't have the options they want.
Yeah. So the change looks like this.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the big questions is how will these third party candidates do in Minnesota, because Minnesota has an independent streak. People want change. They don't like the two. If you wanted a Republican president, they don't really necessarily like their option here for that. So will that mean these third party candidates do better?
Well, what is your sense about how Stein and Gary Johnson will do here?
I think there is a pretty strong libertarian group of Minnesotans. I don't think a lot of people know about him yet. And I don't think a lot of people know about Jill Stein. She did do an event with NOC, Neighborhoods Organizing for Change, recently. And it sounded like it was well attended. But some of the people who I talked to there said she didn't really seem to have good answers on policy questions, which was important. So it'll be, you know, if they get traction, it'll just be gut. It'll just be wanting more.
Something else. Yeah, Catherine.
Right. Wanting something different than what the two major parties are offering. But third-party candidates traditionally don't do well in any part of the country. You know, Jesse Ventura is sort of the obvious outlier there. You know, the U.S. is a two-party system for a lot of reasons. I mean, just look, Ross Perot got 19% of the popular vote and zero electoral college votes. So the system is really designed in such a way that facilitates two parties. And so most conflict, you know, arises within the two-party system. Donald Trump, had he not won the Republican nomination and if he were running as an independent, wouldn't be doing well at all. But he did win the Republican Party nomination. So here we are.
I want to bring up a one issue before we have to close here that I'm really interested in. You guys probably are, too. And that's the voter ID laws and what has been happening in individual states with that and how that might affect turnout. Pat?
They've been going down in state after state.
North
and I think
Carolina,
that is going to affect turnout. And it's going to empower populations that thought that they weren't going to be able to vote. And there's more awareness of it now. And I think it's fired some of them up. So you may see even a higher degree of participation.
What's interesting about it, it has taken, it seems like, this long, right? Some of these laws got passed and individual states. And it seems like it's taken this long for them to work their way through court systems, right? And there were election cycles in the middle of that.
Right, right. But certainly going into 2016, I mean, they will not have the impact that those who, you know, sort of put them on ballots years
Republican legislatures primarily, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Because, I mean, they disproportionately affect individuals who identify as Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And the timing is interesting,
isn't it?
And it's all happening once. I agree with Pat. I think that it will affect voter turnout. I think more people will show up and more people who are likely Democratic voters.
Okay, so I close my roundtables with reading recommendations. Not that you guys... Pat reaches for her book. Excellent.
I brought it.
Okay, so Brianna, to you first then. What have you been reading while Pat pulls out hers?
You know, I'm actually reading David Grand's book, his collection.
City of Z?
Devil and in Sherlock Holmes. So it's a collection of his stories. I just think sometimes we cover the day-to-day story, and it's really nice to stop and read a journalist who has these crazy interesting stories, but also sits down and does this long piece on it. So it's just helpful for me to pull myself out of this horse race kind of coverage and step back with a good, interesting long form.
He has
nonfiction.
A new book coming in the spring.
Ooh.
So I'll tell you that. Yes, we've heard from his publisher about that. And
I'm
it
excited.
Looks really good. Yeah, I'll be in touch with you on that. Catherine, what are you reading?
I am reading About Grace by Anthony Doerr. I loved his sort of bestseller, All the Light You Cannot See.
Right.
And so I'm reading this one actually with my book club, and it is fantastic.
What's it about? I don't know about it.
Well, it is about a man who can predict the future in his dreams. And that doesn't give anything away, but the lengths he goes to essentially to make things not come true. And it leads him literally to the other side of the world. And so it's many different stories sort of together. And it's heartbreaking in many ways, but it's just very powerful.
It's going
and
on my
well-written.
List.
Yeah.
Pat, I see yours.
I am reading The Boys in the Boat.
Everybody's reading The Boys
on
the Boat.
But I started reading it first. It's just taken me a long time.
Why?
It's a wonderful book. It's beautifully written. It has such a strong sense of time and place. And it's that human struggle for greatness and the pain that they endure. He goes deep into the backgrounds of these college boys, and that's what they call them, who came from the most unlikely place, Washington State, to go to Berlin to the 1936 Olympics as the crew champions. And, you know, there was hardly any crew at that time in that part of the country. It was all considered an East Coast elite sport. And, you know, it's just that struggle against all those things, money and power and, you know, establishment and, you know, the most unlikely odds. And yet they overcame them all.
Sounds like kind of a good escape from the election season. Thank you all for an enlightening and a fun roundtable. Appreciate it.